Hello, Brexit Britain. How are you? Welcome back to Remainiac on the week that a final say second referendum seemed to come closer and closer. What did Nigel Farage really think he'd gain from putting it on the table? Why is Boris Johnson wobbling? And why won't Corbyn get with the final say programme? Boris Johnson wobbling. We'll be discussing this in detail later in the show, but first let's say hello to our regular panel of self-consumed malcontents. Ian Dunt is the editor of politics.co.uk. Hello, Ian. How are
hello.
You?
Hello. Very well.
Naomi Smith is former chair of the Social Liberal Forum and ex-Lib Dem parliamentary candidate. Hi, Naomi. Welcome back.
Hello.
And Peter Collins is our resident business expert and social media denier. Hello, Peter.
Hello. Still here and still moaning.
The internet misses you. Did we all enjoy this week's two bulletins from the Brexit fringe? First, there was the heartbreaking story of Henry Bolton and his racist alleged music journalist girlfriend, Jo Marnie.
alleged music journalist. The other way around.
She's clearly a racist, but claims also to be a music journalist. Then a comedy sketch troupe calling themselves the White Pendragons trying to pull off a citizen's arrest of Sadiq Khan because of Magna Carta. Did she die in vain? No, Bolton left his wife for Jo Marnie. Now he's split up for Marnie as well. Can we think of any other rash decisions to leave something, perhaps made in a moment of high emotion, which turned out to be a bad idea and give rise to terrible regret?
He spent the last 3 months doing what he calls internal restructures. I've never heard it called that before.
I didn't know that he was the UKIP leader. This seems terrible.
This is literally the first story about him, I think, since he became UKIP leader. I'm a bit torn, because I get a bit uncomfortable when they start blaming people for the crimes of their partner, for the thoughts of their partner, because you sort of think, well, you know, I mean, you're entitled to go out with people with some very strange views, and our romantic lives do not necessarily follow the same logical structure as our sort of our professional lives. And then you read the stuff that she said, and you sort of think, God almighty, there's no way that none of that seeped out in the conversation, you know. What kind of a judgment would you need to have as a human being to want to be in contact with someone like that? And then I just thought, I don't want to think about this anymore.
And also, UKIP are, you know, they're not a progressive liberal party exactly that believes that you shouldn't be judgmental about people and don't blame their partners for things. It's a kind of traditional values party, so they deserve it, don't they?
It's bizarre that he would just not have noticed. I mean, I think it's quite hard to accidentally date a racist. I imagine you can accidentally go on a first date with a racist, but you probably can't accidentally move in with a racist.
I mean, I think he probably noticed the fact she was a model, and that seemed to have been enough for his marriage. And
what first attracted him to the glamour model?
It's a mystery. But nevertheless, I imagine that that's all that he saw, and his marriage and his conscience just took a backseat to that judgment. Nevertheless, he did get rid of her, sort of. He sort of did this, the romantic section of our relationship is now over and we can move on and I need to worry about the family and the
we'll
blah, blah,
blah. We'll just march around in jackboots together.
But I suspect she got rid of
we'll
him.
We'll still be racist together. We just won't go for dinner.
But they will have both served, you know, the purpose came to a natural end. Mm-mm. Because somebody like her, I mean, let's face it, she probably was not physically attracted to him. It was the power, the fact that he was leader of UKIP. So once his career is on the skids because of her naughty texts and horrible racist comments, you know, I think he no longer served her in much the same way as she certainly was no longer.
That was a very generous equation of power with leadership of UKIP.
True.
At this stage in the game.
But I suppose if you're a 24-year-old racist, the pinnacle of power probably is the leader of UKIP.
Well, either that or the Knights of the Pendragon or whoever.
Pendragon.
Well, the White Pendragons trying to arrest Sadiq Khan at the Fabian Society meeting, which was very comical. It was like a pitch for what if detectorists, but racist. Except they brought an actual gallows with them. And it was very hard to work out whether there was anything kind of dangerous simmering here or if they're just sort of great British wallies. The way that they seem to have, like, I mean, proper crankishness. Now, I think when people talk about people being crankish, they're tending to go to certain wells. You know, the anti-Semitism well and the invasion of the Muslims well. Mm. But this was kind of Magna Carta and the pernicious influence of the Fabians, you know, going back to the 1880s. And it was like, this was real kind of like crate digging. This is some real kind of deep cuts theories here.
Have you seen the video communique from the leader of the White Pendragons?
Unfortunately
on
not.
I'd hesitate to say watch it, but if you want to see a bloke sat in a room with wallpaper peeling off the walls and a parrot somewhere squawking in the background while he's trying to kind of convey that the white race is in danger, then, you know, it's definitely one for the guidebooks, yeah.
There's an ITV, bit of ITV footage where the journalist, I think it's ITV, very, very generously actually asked these guys to try and elaborate on what their politics actually are. And it goes on for some time, and it's fucking bananas. But like halfway through, this one of the people there, this woman, sort of goes, "Can I just say something?" And then she just recites the Magna Carta for about 2 minutes. She's like, I mean,
it's like
sort
a
of
party
impressive.
Trick.
Yeah, like as a feat of memory, there is. Yeah. It's sort of impressive, but you haven't actually said anything. You just recited the Magna Carta for 2 minutes. The most extraordinarily weird cul-de-sac of extremism that they found themselves in, but nevertheless, you know, it's there. And I suppose harks back to some kind of romantic notion of, you know, the dark age British Englishman's liberties sort of stuff, which I guess is there. It was certainly a more eccentric and distracting form of extremism to the sort of anti-Muslim stuff that we usually get.
But, you know, there's also, why does Sadiq Khan constantly have to put up with this shit?
Oh, because they're racist.
Yeah, okay.
just to be clear on that.
That's
one.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. They're just eccentric racists.
Is Magna Carta woman going to go out with Henry Bolton?
That's a good idea.
Can you imagine that? Recite the Magna Carta to me again.
In the next series of blood.
Spank me with a copy of it.
That's enough of that. We'll get to the important stuff after this message from Peter.
Yes, we're renting a transit van, sticking the flag of St. George on it and filling it with cans of Strongbow, because at long last we're doing a live show. The very first Romaniacs Live is happening on Thursday, the 22nd of February, downstairs at the Phoenix Pub near Oxford Circus in central London. So we're not exactly bursting out of our metropolitan bubble just yet. Anyway, put it in your diary. Our panel will be on stage doing a slightly more wide-ranging version of your favourite podcast. We'll be taking a longer view of Britain's future in or out of Europe and what Remain can do to affect that future. There'll be questions from the audience too, plus a chance to mingle with the presenters afterwards. We'll even let you buy us a drink. We have no shame. If it works, and if Ian doesn't stage dive into the crowd, we'll set up some dates outside London too. Tickets are limited, and as promised, Patreon backers get first dibs and discounts. We've sent out the links. You should have them by now. The tickets will go on general sale next week, but if you can't wait, you could always sign up to backers via Patreon right now. Just go to romaniacs.com and follow the links. So that's Romaniacs Live, 22nd of February, Thursday at the Phoenix, Cavendish Square, off Oxford Street in London. For those about to Ramon, we salute you.
Okay, let's have a look at this week's Brexit news. First up, we're going to go back to a story we looked at late last year, the threat to jobs at Vauxhall's car plant Ellesmere Port and how much of the problem is down to Brexit. The company, now owned by PSA, the French manufacturers of Peugeot and Citroën, announced 400 job losses in October and a further 250 this month. It's hard to avoid the conclusion that, like many companies, PSA are getting ready for a post-Brexit world where Britain is not a great place to manufacture. And yet, it's happening against a background of the economy doing rather better than expected in some respects. Now, Peter, you're always saying we shouldn't be sort of delighting in bad news of the economy and feeling sad about the good news. So,
indeed.
Yeah. So what's happening at the moment?
Well, looking at Vauxhall, first of all, there's two big things going on that are not themselves to do with Brexit, but are not made any better by Brexit. First of all, Vauxhall's a bit like Spinal Tap. It's playing to a more select audience these days. Overall sales of cars in Britain fell by 5.7% last year. Sales of Vauxhalls fell by more than 22%. The company's spin is, though, well, you know, we're trying to cut our losses rather than focus on market share. But the point is, they're doing that because the cars are just not selling the way they used to. So the new owners, obviously cutting jobs, going down to one shift a day, putting a big question mark over the future of the factory. Brexit makes this worse because at the moment, most of the cars we make in Britain are exported. Most of the cars that we buy and drive ourselves are imported. That's because we're part of this huge, united, a very open European market with, you know, 500 million plus people in it. Once we're no longer part of that integrated market, PSA, the new owners, might start regarding the British market in isolation. So why continue to build cars that aren't selling very well in a small market where overall sales are also weak? Second thing is we've had years of having too many car factories across Europe. Now something's being done about it. Rationalisation. The biggest part of that so far is General Motors, which has lost billions of dollars over the years on Vauxhall and its German counterpart Opel. Have now sold them to the owners of Peugeot and Citroën. The obvious thing to do now is say, right, we've got all these different models, all these different factories. How can we rationalise them? and the Vauxhall and Opel Astra, the car, the estate version that's built at Ellesmere Port, is a rival to one of Peugeot's models. It's a sort of rival to one of the Citroën models, and therefore, and you've also got a factory in Gliwice in Poland which also makes Astras. So if you're looking to rationalise, that makes Ellesmere Port look pretty vulnerable.
But overall, manufacturing is looking all right at the moment.
Exactly. Manufacturing, in fact, according to the latest figures, is output in Britain is close to its all-time high. There's this myth that manufacturing has declined in Britain. It actually hasn't. There are lots of high-profile manufacturing, the sort of stuff that gets in the headlines, that has strikes and stuff, has declined. But overall output never really did decline. It didn't decline during Margaret Thatcher's era. It actually, when we waved her a fond farewell in 1990, actually manufacturing output...
You waved her a fond farewell.
I think lots of people waved her a fond farewell, including Julian Cope at the time, I remember. Manufacturing output was actually higher than in 1979. There was a big dip in the middle, but it recovered again. It's just that we tend to focus on this 19th century sort of manufacturing fetish, the idea that the manufacturing process, particularly the final assembly process, is where the value is created and where the jobs are created. Neither of those are true anymore. Look at Apple. You know, it doesn't make the iPhone. It makes all the money out of the iPhone because it does the design, the marketing. It has all the money off the services that go with an iPhone, the iTunes and so on, all the advertising and so on. But the assembly is just done by some factory in China, which is on much tinier margins. But we still obsess about having a car factory, assembly factory, as a sort of symbol of national virility. It's just a delusion, rather like some of the delusions around Brexit, actually.
It's such an especially pertinent example, isn't it, as a sort of car goes from being, you know, a lump of manufacturing around some tech into basically a tech product with a manufacturing shell around it. And that becomes more and more the case, those kind of aspects become more and more important. Manufacturing is doing well, which should be to be expected, of course, because sterling went down in value. We've got a very, very strong global economy. China's performing well. The US is performing very, very well indeed. And that means, you know, that you should have pretty strong exports of manufacturing. When you look at construction, which is obviously much more domestic, it is a very, very different story indeed, especially when you look at private sector commercial construction, which looks very bad. And that gives you some indication of the sort of chasm between domestic confidence in Brexit and the kind of confidence we could have around our exports when the pound has been devalued. Even then, exports still haven't performed as well as we expected them to, given the scale of the devaluation. But it would be terribly strange if manufacturing didn't reflect that in some way.
And we do only assemble cars here and, you know, these component parts that are coming across borders. And this is why the customs union issue is so worrying for those sorts of sectors, because we may not meet these EU rules of country origin in the future. So I think the whole fact that we don't actually, you know, manufacture cars per se, we assemble them, is why it's of particular concern when we start talking about that stuff. And you're right, on the wider economic stuff, we should be doing much better than we are. Every other well-developed economy is doing much, much, much better than the UK's is. So, yes, we are sort of doing all right at the moment, a bit boosted by a cheaper pound, but, you know, it's not sustainable.
That's a very important point, and it often gets overlooked. We should be looking not at where we are, where we should be.
And where everyone else is.
Likewise with Brexit and trade in general. You know, there is actually nothing in the EU's rules to stop British manufacturers selling more in China, in India, in America, all around. Because let's face it, that's what German factories are doing. They're in the European Union. It's just that they are better at building the right product and selling it to the right markets. We do not need to do Brexit to improve our export performance and therefore to manufacture more.
And the week's big business story was the collapse of Carillion, which seems to be one of those few stories that, to our chagrin, does not have a Brexit angle.
Oh, it has. Well, I've got two here.
Go on, then.
Name is a difference. Well, first of all, Dennis McShane, the former Labour MP and creative expense claims artist, writing for the excellent Infax website, pointed out that if the government wasn't so tied up with Brexit, which, you know, it by general agreement it is, it might have had a bit more capacity to supervise all of these contracts with with Carillion that are now in trouble. Also, Jolyon Maugham, the barrister, has pointed out that the 28,000 members of the Carillion pension scheme should be jolly grateful that the UK Pension Protection Fund will step in and support them because of an EU regulation which called for the setup of pension protection funds. Yet again, as we said in the very first podcast, when you point out the details of so-called EU bureaucracy to people, they come out. People realise that these are sensible rules and they want to keep them. Do you want your protection of your pension, or don't you?
Well, if there is a Brexit angle, Jolyon Maugham would find it.
Indeed.
And as a campaigner, my view really is that I think the link is around the failings of neoliberal economics that created the conditions that set us up for a Leave vote. And I think that's clearly where we've got a strong link.
They themselves did actually say, I mean, you know, you can take this with as much of a truck full of salt as you want, but the company itself did say, look, it's all to do with Brexit, really. And as soon as Brexit happened, there was a drop-off in interest, drop-off in spending. That's not where government resources were going, and so this majorly damaged us. Again, you know, as many trucks of salt as you want, but they
but it hasn't become that sort of Brexit football that most issues do.
That's like true.
The initial framing of this. I mean, I wonder actually whether it's possible for anything to happen in the economy, which is not in some way either
exactly
affected by or related to and Brexit, but it didn't become that as an arguing point.
And if you've got £1 billion worth of debt on your balance sheet, even a tiny interest rate hike is going to have a cash flow impact, even if you can recoup it through tax later on.
Cool. The second story this week is a bit of a scoop, which the Sky News political editor, Faisal Islam, an Ian favourite, spotted down in the details of the taxation cross-border trade bill. You know the one.
Can we not call him an Ian favourite?
You do. You said he was your, like, hero of 2017.
Well, yeah, but it's a bit embarrassing now that it's part of his job description. We're like, oh, and Ian favourite.
I was just saying that you like the guy. You think he does good work.
I do indeed.
When Corbyn floated the idea of a customs union with Europe, unusually the Conservatives didn't attack him. And why? Perhaps because part of that bill creates the powers to fast-track a new customs union, even within the EU, without the need for new legislation. Ian, does this mean we could leave the EU on March 19th next year and rejoin the customs union the next day?
Well, we certainly won't be leaving any customs union in March 2019, because there'll be at least a 2-year transition, unless everything really goes thoroughly tits up with the deal. So whenever Brexit Day is, it's, you know, pretty likely that there will be a jump into another customs union. There has to be another kind of customs union. It's actually true in this case. You can't stay in this customs union as it is properly done without really being a new member. So when people like Keir Starmer put the emphasis on the word before the phrase customs union, what they're typically doing there is it could be completely interchangeable. It's just, it would technically be a new one in the sense that you can't stay. You'd have to leave, you know, for an hour or whatever it was and then go back in.
They like don't they? It's like a single market.
They love
yeah. I'm looking forward to a European Union. Yeah. Not the European Union.
Of Brexit.
There is the technicality, isn't there, that, if I'm remembering correctly, Turkey is in customs union with the European Union customs union, which is the same as being in the customs union, except that I think that means that they have to accept any trade deals the EU does, but can't guarantee to get the advantages from the other side in the negotiating. So if the EU does a trade deal with Paraguay or something like that, they don't get access to the Paraguayan market.
Yeah, it's hard to, you know, we talk about models like Norway and Calibre. It's hard to think of like a country that gets more fucked in its relationship with the EU than Turkey does, really. Like that it was really intended to be this first step towards eventually joining. You know, back before Erdogan and before, you know, European nativism and all these other things made it basically impossible that we would ever consider such a thing. It was never intended to be somewhere that they would end up. I mean, for a start, that customs union membership of whatever it is doesn't include agriculture, which is absurd because tariffs on most things are down to almost nothing. You know, even on manufacturing, it's pretty low. Agriculture is where your tariffs are high. If you've got a customs union arrangement that doesn't include agriculture, it is just the most pointless thing. And it actually works against Turkey in many respects. You're right, those deals are done, its market is opened up to other countries. And then really, Turkey doesn't really get much penetration into theirs. It doesn't really get any of that quid pro quo. So it's a terror. I mean, no one would ever suggest we wanted to end up like Turkey. Staying in the customs union wouldn't be such a bad idea, though. And that Faisal Islam, I mean, really what he was pointing out was Section 31 of the taxation bill, which seems to give basically just sort of, and I think it's affirmative instruments. They're using a statutory instrument, basically allows a minister just to quickly say, we're in a customs union again now, by the way, no need for a vote. We'll fast track that. Bill Cash, noted Eurosceptic, but not a complete idiot, noticed this, actually, and sort of started asking questions of Mel Stride, who's financial secretary to the Treasury. And it was very clearly said to him, no, that is basically what it allows us to do, including the existing customs union with the EU. So all of that is clear. It doesn't necessarily mean the government is going to do it. And I think we'll end up talking about this a bunch, looking at what was signed up to in that first phase agreement on regulatory alignment and what that might mean, actually, to Britain. I think it is really about giving them the power to do it if they need to move very, very quickly as Brexit talks continue.
And a customs union is fine for goods because it gets rid of tariffs and border checks, but it really does nothing at all on services. And of course, as much as our government fetishizes the automotive industry, we really are a service-led economy. And even the FTA with Canada doesn't really go very far on services. And we've seen financial services, I know it's a bit of a dirty word for many Remainers, but in particular saying it's unacceptable in the long term that the UK becomes a rule taker. And they're arguing for these comprehensive trade agreements, allowing for this mutual mechanism of future divergence. Blah, 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 all horrible financial services words. But Barnier has pretty much ruled out even that in the last few days.
It would. I mean, it's really hard to imagine us leaving the single market and staying in the customs. It's such a weird arrangement that you would have, really. And then, you know, at the end of it, you still wouldn't be able to sign any future trade deals and blah, blah, blah. But it is interesting. You know, Labour are quite clearly thinking about it as part of the puzzle. The Tories clearly haven't really ruled it out becoming warmer on it. There's evidently some kind of change going on there.
Finally, a little light Kremlinology regarding Theresa May's reshuffle and the Tories' internal psychology. One little notice appointment in Mrs. May's homeopathic reshuffle was Suella Fernandez, who has been made a junior minister at Dexune. She's the chair of the rabidly aerophobic European Research Group, and she was the MP who coordinated a letter from Tory MPs which aimed to block any transition arrangements because they meant we'd be, quote, in the EU by stealth. She's a big fan of no deal, and in many of her positions on Europe, she's flatly opposed to Theresa May. Ian, tell us about her.
Yeah, especially this European Research Group link is interesting. She's the former chair of this group. And for those that don't know, it basically functions sort of as a party within a party. It's a hard Brexit caucus, really. I mean, it, to the point of, you'd say, pushing for no deal, certainly it holds a very firm line on not in the single market, not in the customs union.
But its name sounds so harmless and benign.
It does.
Momentum, perhaps they've made some kind of mistake there.
Yes, indeed.
By choosing such a harmless name.
You're quite entitled to at least go sort of waist-deep in conspiracy think around these guys, really. Because, I mean, you know, they have a very secretive WhatsApp group. It's basically considered It's not secretive, it's just no one else wants to join us. Okay, so anyway, I mean, they have it's thought that basically they do have a kind of a whip that they function as an internal party whip. If anyone steps out of line, they go for them. They keep a pretty regimented line on how they approach these things. When we come in and some sort of concession has been made and we go, why aren't the Brexit guys losing their minds? It's mostly because somewhere, we presume, that is the line that's coming in from these guys. Now, she has gone off to join DexEU. The former chair, Steve Baker, has gone off to join DexEU. These two guys, the new ones, fucking Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, would you believe it? These guys are now just embedded in the department. Now, of course, for a while, Baker was going to be the no-deal minister until Theresa May realised that she had no executive power to move anyone at all, and so everyone had to stay exactly where they are. But still, you've got two chairs now moving from that group, very, very well-funded group, predominantly, it seems, by the way, through MPs using their expenses to kick back against the money that they donate to the group. So, by the way, all of this stuff is basically taxpayer-funded. We now have two of them embedded in DexEU, which raises a lot of questions when we start saying, again, what does regulatory alignment mean in that first phase deal that British government has signed up to? Who is going to be the person in the department saying, well, actually, that can't mean what it seems to mean on a piece of paper? It seems to me that it will be her and it will be Baker.
But isn't DexEU basically just there for show? Isn't Downing Street really calling all the shots? Aren't they going to just spend their whole days sending memos to each other?
I don't know. I don't know if it's just there for show. I think stuff goes on. I know that increasingly David Davis has talked about as this sort of bonhomie mask on the face of somebody else. But yeah, well, I don't know if that one holds anymore. I don't know if it's just there for show. I mean, there is stuff that is going on there. At the moment, it's very, very hard to tell where the centre of power lies. I think because there is no centre of power in government. There's just no one with enough authority and enough connections in order to really make decisions that have any lasting effect.
And is she talented? Is she impressive? Or is it just that her views fit? Because it seems like at the moment, if your views fit, you're going to get the sort of plum jobs at the moment because...
No, she's a moron. You could see, I mean, if you go back, there's some clips of her. I would advise you to look at it from 6 months ago on Question Time. When people first started talking about the $50 billion EU divorce bill, and she says, oh, you know, don't worry about that. That's just more Project Fear. And so really, she's just the same old Brexiter.
Yeah.
They're 6 months behind reality, and they're still calling it Project Fear. She's not particularly impressive in herself. She's exactly what you say. She's got the right politics at the right time, and that's why she's been installed.
And that politics is that she voted in favour of repealing the Human Rights Act, against plans to save the steel industry, for reducing corporation tax, for phasing out secure tenancies, against measures to climate change. I'm going to leave it to listeners to decide whether their little WhatsApp group is actually called Very Stable Geniuses.
I think it should be called I think it should be called These Fucking People. This week's show is brought to you with the support of ShipStation, the genius shipping software that helps you get ship done. We've got a special offer for Romaniacs listeners. You can use ShipStation for free for 30 days with the promo code Romaniacs. Do you sell online through eBay, Amazon, or Magento, the X-Men villain, or maybe Shopify like we do with Romaniacs merchandise? Then you know that just getting your orders out the door to your customers is tricky and time-consuming. ShipStation is the fast and easy shipping software that puts all your orders from over 60 popular selling channels in one easy-to-use place. ShipStation connects to major shopping channels including Shopify, eBay, Etsy, and more, and it lets you set and forget your shopping parameters so you don't have to enter them over and over for different stores. It's web-based, so you don't have to mess about with software, downloads, and installation. And you can use it to compare rates from top couriers, including the Royal Mail, FedEx, DHL, and UPS, so you get the best shipping deal quickly and easily. Now you can try ShipStation free for 30 days and get a special bonus when you use the promotion code Romaniacs. To get this special promotion, just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Romaniacs. That's ShipStation.com, promotion code Romaniacs. It's good ship. Now we have a special message for Nigel Farage. Nigel, please stop making big announcements immediately after we've recorded an episode of Romaniacs. It's awkward and embarrassing. Last week, no sooner had we packed away the microphones than the television personality and seven times failed parliamentary candidate announced that he was suddenly quite into the idea of a second referendum, or rather he now thinks another vote is increasingly likely if Parliament rejects whatever deal May comes up with. And he thinks leavers need to be ready to fight again to silence Remainers for a generation. He later clarified his remarks, obviously, saying that a second referendum was the last thing he wanted, but that the leave side had to be ready for one. He admitted to The Observer that Brexiters were losing the argument on Brexit due to Remain campaigners making all the running. I think he means us. This produced a febrile week in which prominent Remainers, including friend of Romaniacs Andrew Adonis, effectively said bring it on. UKIP's star-crossed lover Henry Bolton claimed that Farage misspoke and didn't really want another referendum. He's an expert on misspeaking this week. The Sun reported that Boris Johnson had admitted to friends that he'd rather stay in the EU than endure a soft Brexit. And Jeremy Corbyn insisted that Labour wouldn't support another vote no matter what, while reiterating his favourite untruth that the single market is dependent on membership of the European Union. Let's start with Nige. Naomi, why has he suddenly put this on the table?
Well, he started a bit of a trend because since then we've had Donald Tusk appealing to Theresa May for a second referendum using that sort of hackneyed phrase, democracy ceases to be a democracy if it can't change its name. And then we've had Juncker weighed in as well. But back to Farage, I find it pretty hard to believe that he would make such a remark and for it to be ill-considered. He's not somebody that tends to shoot from the hip. He's quite a calculated political operator, and I've listened back to it a few times, and it wasn't misspeaking. He'd set out to say that. So I'd be very surprised, very, very surprised, if both sides weren't continuing to be doing private polling throughout all of the trade negotiations. So is he just trolling us? Perhaps. Is he anxious that if he is seen to oppose a second referendum, that will make him look bad because of all of his constant support for referenda and always talking them up, potentially? Or what's most likely is that they're just doing a lot of scenario planning and they are pretty confident that they will not win the vote in the Commons on the meaningful vote stuff later this year, sort of October, November time. I think we're expecting that. So perhaps he's now thinking that the only way he's going to get the kind of Brexit he wants is to go back to the people for it. He'll have seen Justine Greening go and sit next to Dominic Grieve the first day after she left the cabinet. And perhaps he just thinks he can't rely on Parliament to deliver it. And I guess we'll find out in 2018.
And UKIP said that they were on their Twitter account that their members were ready for war.
Oh, good. Well, they're all so responsible with their language.
Yeah,
they?
I know.
Yeah, good for them.
I have a question to put to you. So the YouGov's poll on whether people want a second referendum says 36% now say we should have one, up from 32% in October. 43% say we shouldn't have a second referendum. That's down. And the don't knows are about the same, 21%. The only... Obviously, as Naomi is pointing out, a lot of people will be doing private polling, but just because it's private polling, I don't think it makes it any better. And also, you're asking people, what's your view on a second referendum that you don't really think is going to happen, that nobody is really saying will happen?
And that you don't know what the question is going to be.
You don't know what the question is going to be and the conditions. I think it requires heroic assumptions to think there's anything that such polling can tell us, I guess, yeah?
I don't know about that. I mean, I certainly know that the internal polling that Remain guys have done on how you would approach things would mostly indicate that if you say, would you like a second referendum, it is completely toxic.
And people not hate another the one. Yeah,
exactly, all of that. And Remainers seem to hate it really rather a lot, and Leavers hate it obviously considerably more than that. If you say, would you like a referendum on the final terms, that is a very different question, and that's treated in a very, very different way. There was a polling put out actually by Lord Ashcroft today. Lord Ashcroft turning into kind of a fucking punchline because of his, you know, he's putting up polls on Twitter and then talking about, and you just think, like, what are you doing, mate? You're actually like a pollster, for God's sake. Don't start putting surveys up on Twitter. Nevertheless, the results today I thought were very, very interesting. There's about four options, but the straight one, do you want a second referendum on Brexit, had 38% were for it and 51% were against it. All of that changes and becomes much tighter if you start talking about, do you want to vote on the final terms? But the thing is, a vote on the final terms is not the same thing either way. A vote on the final terms where a no means it's no deal and we leave anyway is very, very different to a vote on the final terms and it means that we stay. And the results of that were weird. So if it's you're voting on the final terms and a no means no deal and we leave anyway, it's 39 pro versus 31 anti. That was the only scenario in which there was overall public support for holding a referendum. However, a second referendum on the final terms, where you stay in if you vote against the deal, was 40% pro and 42% against. Now, that is a huge change from where we were a year ago. And I think the polling on the second referendum, when it's spoken about as the final terms, actually has been shifting our way rather a lot. If you look at some of the stuff that's been coming out, the Servation poll for the Mail on Sunday in December, much more sympathetic. The BMG one for Left Foot Forward, much more sympathetic. And that was on, if there's no deal, would you like a second referendum on being able to do this stuff? So actually, I think that we can get something from it. I also think, because I'm naturally of an optimistic disposition, but also because the polling suggests it, that if there was a second referendum, I think that it's very, very winnable.
Yeah. Well, the first way of phrasing it, of course, is it's just nonsense, because it you get this argument from a great thinker like Piers Morgan, where it's just like, it's like you're gonna. It's like a rerun. He goes, oh, what are we going to do? Best of three? I mean, forgetting.
There's already been one.
There's already been one in the 70s. Yeah. But, you know, and it's like, I haven't seen anybody proposing that we just, like, forget the last one. And do everybody
well,
talking
apart from
about...
Farage, so that is the interesting part, that, of course, his thing was not about on the final terms. His thing was, we have Brexit referendum. And he knows that. I think they really would win very stonky.
And he almost went into multiple choice answers. He was almost suggesting that, you know.
Oh, really?
It sounds like a sort of press officer comes in and sort of shuts him up a bit halfway through that. And that would, of course, require a change in the voting system and everything. I think what's really interesting as well is around the public perception of how the government is handling Brexit, and that's been getting worse and worse and worse. And what we need to do is to get voters to make that leap from, this isn't just the Tories handling it very badly, it's they need to make that jump from, but nobody could handle it well because Brexit is a dreadful, terrible idea.
Yes, well, or do you? Because if everything is focused on the final deal, it sort of doesn't matter whether it's sort of a priori or a posteriori. I mean, the thing is, people are voting against that deal, and that is the only one that's on the table. If you look at the YouGov tracker, which has been showing strong Leave support throughout from the referendum itself all the way through to August. Suddenly in August, there's a change where the country flips, and actually you've got a pretty strong Remain lead. And that stayed there, and I think that's because we're talking about the stuff that she's coming back with from Brussels. Mm. We're finally talking in quite concrete terms about where things are. We're going to pay this much. This is how this bit will work. We're talking about Ireland. We're talking about technicalities. And that, I think, fundamentally changes it. I'm going to pour cold water over everything I just said now and say that I don't get the timetable. I don't see how... I don't see where, I don't see the practicalities of how you would hold it. Because the only way, if it's going to be on a final deal, is if you put an amendment down to the primary legislation that will go to Parliament, which contains the withdrawal deal from the EU. We know that's what David Davis has said he's going to do. They're going to put that forward. They also have this commitment that they're going to put this vote in front of Parliament before the European Parliament votes. So that sounds like it would give us about October, November time, 6 months before leaving. Very, very tight, but you could do it. But that commitment isn't actually for the primary legislation. That commitment's actually for a motion before Parliament. And that you can't put amendments down on. So there isn't any mechanism there. The legislation would presumably be pushed back as far as you possibly can because you'd have got the support of Parliament on the motion. And therefore, the mechanism for how you legally hold it in time to do it before Brexit happens seems very, very mysterious to me. The practicalities of it don't seem to work in my head. I think that there would be public support for it, and I think that'll grow over the year. I think it could be won if it was held. I just don't know how you get to the point where you're actually holding the bloody thing.
What do you think of this theory that actually the leavers who don't feel very comfortable with sort of victory and still prefer to see themselves as the sort of the insurgents against the elites, even when they are in control, well, allegedly in control, it's almost as if like they don't want this sort of responsibility, or they seem very unhappy with sort of victory. And so there's a theory that almost Farage, for his own sort of purposes and, you know, wants sort of Brexit to fail in some way. But that seems quite kind of, that seems quite a leap to see that they're sabotaging, literally sabotaging something that he's been campaigning for years, basically to keep his TV appearances up. Let's face it, he's never fucking off the telly. So I don't really know how much more prominent he could be. Like I said, they are carrying, they're still talking like insurgents anyway. Leave.eu are still talking like some kind of like irate far right cell. So I don't follow that theory at all.
Well, it is comfortable to be in opposition. I'm sure there are lots, in a general election, there are lots of MPs who go into the election talking, we're going to win, but hoping actually be quite nice to have an opposition position maybe in the shadow cabinet and to be able to sit there and criticise and say, I wouldn't have done it this way. The government's doing everything all wrong. And if you're Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage now, you must be thinking, well, we're not going to get the Brexit that we promised because we knew it was impossible anyway. So wouldn't it be better to see the whole thing called off and sit there and saying, oh, you see, if they'd done Brexit properly our way, it would be different, you know. And you know. But it's a comfortable opposition place to be in.
I think that is quite a kind analysis, and you are a very kind person, and I'm probably less kind when it comes to politicians. I think that what we've seen in 2016 and 2017 and now into 2018 is this culture of the really angry winner. And you're seeing it in America with Trump, and you're seeing it with these, you know, far-right Tories and UKIPers, and they just are perpetually in this fifth gear of anger. And it's weird, and I don't want them to be running the country and leading us crashing out of the EU.
I don't. You're right. It sort of feels like I don't really want to get tangled up in the emotional and psychological needs of Nigel Farage. I do know that I thought, I also, by the way, don't think that he's some kind of strategic. I mean, like you say, he's run for Parliament seven times and he's fucked it up every single time. You know, I mean, he is not this great scheming mastermind. I just don't see that. But I do think it's useful that he said it, because it just detoxifies the idea. You can always just get to point out, well, it can't be that off the scale. I mean, your own guy, Nigel Farage, has been saying it the whole time. So I was happy that he said it.
It seems like it has to be a sort of own guy. It has to help us, whatever his thinking behind it is.
Yeah,
completely. Just the fact that he's kind of, the Overton window or whatever is, if you've got Nigel Farage going, maybe a second referendum, you're like, all right.
Indeed, he has stretched that window to full capacity.
And what about Boris Johnson, who's apparently told friends that he thinks May will cave and we'll have a Brexit so soft there's no point leaving. And I'm sure to his horror, those friends then told the press. So now it's out there with red faces all round for Bozza. But then he's also doubling down on the infamous bus lie and saying that £350 million was in fact too low a figure. And people are suggesting that it actually doesn't matter if it's a lie, because even just bringing it back to the cost of EU membership is a good thing. I don't really know what's going. If we're going to get into his, if we're going to psychoanalyze somebody else, what's he up to?
Don't you find that there's like a set of people out there who just cannot analyze any event outside of the prism of liberals/remainers are getting a spanking? Because it just doesn't, you know, because it just doesn't seem to me that that's what's happening. And yet that's the only capacity they have of looking at each current event. if he's talking about what is considered by the general public to be the big lie of the campaign, I just do not see that that is damaging towards Remainers in any way, shape or form. His movements are definitely interesting. And again, the third time I've mentioned in this, but it is, to me, the most important thing that is happening right now. It all comes down to that first phase agreement, that phrase, full regulatory alignment on Section 49, which is the bit on the Irish border. What the fuck does it mean? Because if it means mutual recognition, as they're all saying in Westminster, it doesn't mean anything. But that would suggest that the EU is going to throw Ireland to the wolves and all that damage, which I don't think is credible. If it means what it seems to mean, which is that basically you're going to sign up to the single market and the customs union, the Brexiters are going to have a shit fit to rival all possible historical shit fits. So that part, that debate, that internal debate, seems to me where I presume what Boris Johnson is talking about when he starts putting this stuff out there, when he starts seeing shifting around, when we see those additions to the taxation bill and the customs union. That is where everything is right now. And that kind of question, I think will probably, I don't think they can roll that fudge over past March 2019. I think that question has to get decided this summer. That's when the climax of this whole thing.
And what about his personal ambitions? You know, if the devil came to Boris Johnson again and said that he could be prime minister if Brexit was just dead,
well,
would he say yes, please?
I mean, if we know anything about Boris, it's that he is a completely self-centred careerist. And here he is trying to make hay out of an NHS winter crisis. You know, I'll be the saviour because I'll make sure it gets 400 million a week or whatever, while having a right old pop at May at the same time. You know, let's forget that he also voted for a £40 billion Brexit fee. He is utterly shameless. But were he to somehow ensure that we remained, I think his political ambitions would be toast. He would be disliked by both Leavers and Remainers. And that sounds almost a bit too ideal to me.
So just quickly on Jeremy Corbyn, Andrew Adonis was confident last week about Jeremy's long game. But is it time to get off the fence now and support this final say referendum? Or is his kind of, is his plan that the sort of government will collapse and then Labour can reject Brexit under representative democracy and
I thought Adonis, you know, was extremely caustic and wonderful guest and probably a little bit marginally overconfident on this issue of how likely it is that Labour would go for a second referendum. But you can't rule it out. I mean, you have Labour front bencher after Labour front bencher is constantly like, we're not supporting a second referendum now, which is always this sort of thing, like, well, if I really feel like something could be read into that. And yet Starmer, the Shadow Brexit Secretary, seemed to thoroughly discourage that in a meeting with the Labour Parliamentary Party the other day. Seemed to really say, stop trying to rub out Brexit, we're trying to go for it. However, you look at some of those comments that he made, again, he started saying to them, look, I've told you before, we say you get all of the same benefits of the single market and the customs union, or we're not going to support it. Now, he has said this for a long time, to be fair to him, and he says, this is the thing to tell your constituents, this is the thing to tell your friends. I think, like, what deal are they going to bring back that will possibly involve that criteria? And it seems a pretty heavy wink to me that they're going to vote against the deal. Because, of course, one of the great mysteries is, what does Labour do with that bill or that motion, whatever it looks like? If it comes back, if they vote for it, they're supporting the whole government's work for the last 2 years, which is an unusual thing for an opposition to do. If they vote against it, they cause all this chaos. And that seemed to me a pretty heavy indication they would vote against it, at least. Not sure what it means for a second referendum.
Maybe that explains, if you read between the lines, Emily Thornberry's comments. She was asked about it and she said, well, look, we're not in favour of a referendum. But of course, if 90% of the public were demanding one, obviously, as a Democrat, that puts you under a lot of pressure. So you can imagine a scenario in which we're building up towards the deal. It suits the Labour leadership to say, this isn't good enough. This isn't good enough. We're not getting full access to the single market, the customs union. We're not getting this. We're not getting that. So we're the focus of Labour campaigning becomes the deal is a bad deal. The deal is a bad deal. And they hope then to affect public opinion. And lo and behold, you've got the 90%, including Conservative Remainers, saying, let's have another referendum.
90% seems a little high.
Well, no, she obviously doesn't mean literally 90%. Yeah. If it were 74%, I think that would do. You know, what she means is a clear majority of the public in favour of a referendum. Likewise, Ruth Davidson saying she didn't want a second referendum because she thinks referendums are a bad idea. That, if you listen very carefully, doesn't sound like let's not have a referendum. It's just saying the first bit. It's saying we don't like referendums. They're a stupid idea, which is she's right about, of course. It doesn't mean that she would be against a second referendum, I don't think, if one were in prospect.
Back to Corbyn, I think Remainers just must get much better at selling the European Union to him and the whole, you know, anti-Brexit agenda. This is somebody who represents a wing of a party that has waited decades and decades to get control and get power. And if he inherits the earth just after we've crashed out, it's going to put back that brand of socialism a century again, because the economic turmoil will all be blamed on Corbynism rather than Brexit. And so, you know, my pitch to him is that you've got this right-wing nuttery in America, you've got China in ascendancy on the other side of the planet, and in the middle, you've got this enormous trading bloc that is absolutely crying out for leadership at the moment, and that he could be the sort of person that would provide that leadership, being a bastion of workers' rights, cooperatives, mutualism, industrial democracy, all the sorts of things that I think, you know, he is very passionate about. And that's how we need to go about selling pro-Europeanism to him. And so, Remainers, we do have some power. There is stuff you can do. And I think we need to sort of start making this kind of a pitch to him.
And finally, if there is a second referendum, we've got, quite apart from the fact of some, you know, regretful Leave voters changing sides, we've got an actuarial churn, whatever you call it, with old people dying and more people getting to 18. And, of course, a lot of those voters who did not turn out, the pro-Remain people who did not turn out last time, would turn out. So it seems like there's these really strong, obvious advantages. Money on the table, would Remain win?
Oh, definitely, I'd put my money on that. I mean, I think the bigger thing about that really is that people have now had 2 years of seeing what a Brexit vote entails, which is an awful lot of technical jargon dominating their TV and radio stations for the whole time. And that is very, very different to the everyone gets their own unicorn referendum campaign that we had before, of projecting everyone's hopes and aspirations, whether, you know, they're in post-industrial towns in the north or whether they're in the golf clubs in the shires in the south. Everyone having that shared fantasy of completely mutually incompatible economic demands. And when that's turned into the reality that it has been for the last 2 years, Brexit becomes something really quite tedious rather than something revolutionary.
What if you phrase it as, would you like us to stay in the European Union, you never have to talk about this again? Or would you like to continue leaving the Union and grind on for seven more years with this on the news every fucking day?
It'll be a landslide.
Until you scream.
I don't think it's fair wording.
I don't know what Lord Ashcroft would make of that wording, but I like
slip
it.
Slip a few quid to the Electoral Commission and we'll get away with it.
And that's the end of our show for this week. Before we go, to give the show a bit of balance and to honour Jacob Rees-Mogg, the new chair of the European Research Group, we're going to work out our Tory names. You might have seen this on social media. You take the first name of one grandparent and the name of the road you grew up on, and you hyphenate it with the name of your first headmaster or mistress. Mine is Wilfred Lammerby Anthony. He's a veteran Home Counties MP who would like to bring back hunting, compulsory Latin lessons, and the old Robinson's marmalade mascot. Naomi, what's yours?
Ina Hawthorne Spring, which sounds quite lower middle class to me, I think.
That sounds nice.
She sounds quite likeable. She might be one of those kind of Remainy rebel types.
She wrote lovely novels about nurses.
Ian?
Azucena Chilbolton Kefford. Which is very strange. That doesn't
mean, can
you
run that one by as a game?
Well, Azucena is the name of abuelita, but my grandmother, and then Chilbolton I grew up in, and Kefford, Mr. Kefford, is the headmaster. And
would this be the Tory MP most likely to have to keep spelling his name over the phone?
Yes, no, indeed. Yeah, that would be a bit of a struggle for him and also his ethnic upbringing. But nevertheless, nothing that I haven't dealt with myself.
Okay, Peter? My turn. Wait, actually, let's see. My high Tory name comes out as Sir William Netherly Skidmore, which is rather posh, isn't it? It makes Jacob Rees-Mogg sound
rather...
Well,
you added sir to it, which, yeah. I mean, no one instructed you to do that.
No, the thing is that my Sir William is a complete imposter. He's actually the son of a butcher who went to a state school in Widnes, but who dresses in tweed and pretends to be
Tory.
Exactly,
they're
part of the landed gentry, yes.
This is all part of research for a novella that Peter will be writing. His high Tory alter ego. We'll be back next week. Remember, the first Remaniacs Live is at the Phoenix, Cavendish Square, London, on Thursday, the 22nd of February. If you enjoy this episode of Remaniacs, you might want to try some of our past shows with highly entertaining guests, including Nick Cohen, Gina Miller, Suzanne Moore and Nick Clegg. There's links to our archive at Remaniacs.com. For this week's Europhone sign-off, we have another rock and roll Remaniac. It's Peredur Ap Gwynedd, who plays guitar for drum and bass band Pendulum, with a bit of Welsh.
Mae Liam Fox fel rhech mewn potyn jam.
And here's our theme tune, Demon is a Monster from Corner Shop, available now on all download stores and Spotify, and the traditional roll call of Patreon supporters. See you next week.
And it's thanks from me to Paul Weatherilt, Tim Cobbett, David Clark, David Sheriff of Brexitus the Musical fame, thanks again for the Christmas carols, David, and Chris Eason.
Many thanks to Daniel Jacobs, Mimbashir Meehan, Tom Vaymeyer, Lars Klartwitter, and Sean Jones.
It's hello and thanks from me to Chris Jones, Helen Micklewright, Andrew Sharp, Morwen Taylor, and Pete Smith.
And thanks for me to Felicity Thompson, Eliza Wheaton, Tom Blakeman, Jerry Gunnigan, and Gail Irvin.
Romaniacs was presented by Dorian Linsky with Ian Dunt, Peter Collins, and Naomi Smith. The producers were Andrew Harrison and Matt Hall. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.